Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
As part of the research for her book, Special Delivery, author and philatelist Marcia Myers took a trip to the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum in Washington, D.C. Many of the photos she saw there are included in her book. She feels that sending a letter is the next best thing to showing up personally at someone's door. A real connection is made, unlike today's electronic communication, that you can share, love, and connect through the written word. Marcia Myers, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, since Christmas is just a couple of days away, I wanted to ask you about the section in your book when you talk about Christmas, because I remember as a kid writing Christmas cards and getting Christmas cards, and that was a real highlight, and people don't do that so much anymore.
No, they don't, absolutely. I started with actually that I used to sit down at home at our dining room table with felt pens, crayons, stickers. In those days, we weren't using glitter as much, and a pad of paper, actually. Sometimes a Sears catalog, or possibly a list that I had made from magazine advertisements that I had seen. And I would sit down and write to Santa.
Because you include in your book the section Letters to Santa Claus, and I was amused that the first early in this custom, they would drop the letters down the chimney?
Absolutely. In fact, yeah, that didn't last long, though. They found that, obviously they could be burned, set the house on fire.
So that was not a good idea to send your letter to Santa by dropping it down the chimney.
No, it was not.
So then what became of the letters to Santa when children would put these in the mail?
Most of the time, the family member may have to intercept them, and they might be addressed to the North Pole, and a family member would intercept them or possibly even a postal carrier.
Well, the letters to Santa are sometimes, the ones we hear about, are very touching, often quite sad, and it makes us want to help out this child in whatever way that we can. So who answers these letters, if they get answered?
It's possible that a family member does, mother or father, or even an older sibling. Though many years ago, there were carriers that would answer the letters. There was people that volunteered for the Postal Service that would actually respond and reply to children. And in fact, some kids that came from needy homes, it was quite possible that their own postal carrier would even fulfill their Christmas wish just with one item from their list.
So postal employees would answer these letters to Santa. Volunteer citizens would answer these letters to Santa. And you didn't happen to include it in your book, but I know there are certain places in the United States that are favorites to have the postmark from places that say Santa in them.
Yes, yes, they do. And in fact, some actually will say the North Pole.
So they're postmarked and they are put in the mail, and the children sometimes actually get a gift.
Yes, they do. Yes,
from the employees. Well, speaking of the postmark and Christmas time, the cover of your book, actually your book has a cover. It's a hardbound, and you have a cover that is the hardbound portion. But then your dust jacket has a photograph of a post mail carrier delivering a letter to a lady, and there is a postmark stamped Chico, December the 23rd, 1906, exactly 110 years ago today.
Oh my goodness.
This postmark. So where did you get that? I assume this is an actual postmark that you found.
Well, during my research, I collected a lot of philately, including letters from people locally. Originally, when I first started this project, I was going to call it Special Delivery from My Hometown Chico, because My Hometown Chico is the title of two of my other books. And I'm local, born and raised here. I love the history of Chico. But as I went further within to the project, I realized it was so much more than just something that could be about Chico. So when I did start, I put the word out to friends, family, neighbors, and I was specifically interested in finding older mail and envelopes or first day covers. Happened my neighbor, who is 84 years old, had a collection of letters that he had written to his mother, as well as letters that his mother had written to his father and even his grandparents. So that stamp actually came from an envelope from Phil Peters, who was my neighbor.
So you have an actual stamp that says Chico, December 23rd, 12:30 p.m., 1906. Now,
yes,
that's something that I remember. It used to be much more detailed, the postmark did.
Yes.
And now there's very little detail on the postmark.
No, and in fact, they sometimes really don't use postmarks. Sometimes they are just stamped with a computer stamp. In fact, when I go to the Chico office, I always ask for them to hand stamp my letter so it says it's coming from Chico, California, and not Sacramento.
Uh-huh. My guest is Marcia Myers, and I introduced her as author and philatelist, and you used that word, but you didn't explain, and I think most people may know, but what is a philatelist?
It's a funny word, and in fact, in the beginning, I didn't know I was a philatelist. it was something that I just had no idea. In fact, I even had a problem pronouncing the word, philately, philatelist, philately. A philatelist is somebody that studies post history or collects anything that is post-related.
Well, most people use the term as a stamp collector.
Yes, yes. But no, it is not just
it's a broader meaning than that.
Much broader meaning. I'm not just a stamp collector. In fact, I'm someone that loves historic letters. I love the art of writing. I love the beauty of stamps. They're all individual works of art. But I'm especially interested in the evolution of mail delivery. And yes, that is all combined as the hobby of being a philatelist.
My guest is Marcia Myers, and she has, I almost hesitate to use just the word written a book because that doesn't seem adequate, because what you have done, you have not just written a book. You have collected so many photographs. And Marcia, when I was reading your book, I would think, okay, I'm going to put this book down and go make myself a cup of tea. But I find, but I got to read one more page.
Oh.
And I turned one more page because it was so interesting. And the photographs were so fascinating that I really enjoyed that.
That warms my heart.
So you mentioned that you enjoyed studying the history of how this all came about. So how far back were you able to go?
Well, actually, when you speak of me being a writer, I never really look at myself as being an author or a writer. I think of myself as a creator and an artist. And in fact, I wouldn't have been able to do this book without the graphic artist involved, highly involved, who happens to be one of my very dear friends. Her name is Connie Ballou. And in the very beginning of me coming to her with just the very bare bones of this idea, she started thinking about it and started feeling my passion and my love for the romance of letter writing. And together we were able to not only find pictures, but I purchased eBay items of individual envelopes, letters, stamps, different mail items just to use for art in this book.
Yeah, I wondered where you got some of them, because you mentioned going to the Smithsonian, and mm-hmm. that's where you got some of your photographs.
Mm-hmm.
But the others, I wondered, where did you get these photographs?
Well, many photos came from the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum. And in fact, that was the changing point for me from going from my hometown, or special delivery from my hometown Chico, to actually just a national book called Special Delivery. When I went to the National Postal Museum's Smithsonian's library to research for this book, I fell in love with the evolution of mail delivery and the black and white photographs that showed that history. When I worked with a curator and library specialist there, I explained my idea for this book, and they became very supportive. They've never seen a book like this before, at least my idea.
It really is a unique book.
Right, it is.
And they recognize that.
They did recognize that. And so they gifted me the photographs. I didn't have to purchase them. And they gifted me the photographs because they believed in my project. Other photographs came from people that, for instance, Mail in a Pail, which is from Detroit. I actually had to call.
Pail referring to?
A bucket. A bucket. Mail is actually, it, and still to this day, is put in a bucket and driven by boat out to a larger ship and hoisted up to the ship.
Which is why it had to be put in a pail, in
exactly,
a bucket, so
exactly,
it could travel by boat.
And I couldn't come across any of those at the National Postal Museum, so I actually just called Michigan. And they were happy to take photos off the walls of their office. And this wasn't a postal office. It was just a boat office. And they scanned those pictures and emailed them to me for the book.
Which reminds me, it's kind of a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, electronic communication has meant the decline of handwritten notes, but it does allow you to do what you just described, that they can send you electronically these wonderful photographs.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And that's very helpful. But for instance, I cover cursive writing in this book. And where would we be if we could not read cursive writing? Because we're so rich with history, with the letters and the documentation that were all written in script so many years ago. Today, my son, when he was in the fourth grade, I believe he had maybe 1 hour a week that focused on cursive writing. Some schools no longer even include it in their curriculum.
In fact, I treasure letters from my grandmother, mm-hmm, written before the Palmer method was taught in,
yes,
schools. It's,
yes,
been Spencerian. And there's my grandmother's handwriting that is so typical of the age when she was a schoolgirl.
And beautiful, so beautiful. And actually artwork. And doesn't it make you feel closer to your grandmother?
Oh, it absolutely does, because I can see her personality coming through her handwriting.
Yes, she can.
And
yes,
I really treasure that. And it is a shame that that is being lost.
It is. I have high hopes for the Postal Service and mail and letter writing. And it actually comes from large companies like Amazon that have really given the Postal Service a huge boost with Amazon Prime, 2-day shipping. How exciting is that? You can just order it and it is at your doorstep in 2 days. But it's also helping people to use the mail service for writing as well. And in fact, just this holiday season, the USPS plans to deliver 750 million packages within the holiday season.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
But when you're speaking of handwriting, I, in fact, years ago made a study of handwriting. I actually taught a course, mm-hmm, because I find that you can see the personality come through the formation of the letters, the way it's balanced on the page. And I was fascinated, and I always have been, as I know you have been.
I have been.
From what you say, your whole life.
My entire life. And I didn't realize I was a philatelist. I've saved letters. I've saved love letters. I have postcards from my father when he was first on sabbatical on the Hoopa Indian Reservation in the Klamath Mountains. At that point, I was 3. But in elementary school.
So your father was an anthropologist?
Yes, a professor of anthropology at Chico State. It was when I was in elementary school, he went again on sabbatical and was on the reservation. And that's how I corresponded with my father, was by letter writing. And I would wait for the mail every day. It was so exciting to get a letter from my daddy.
My guest is Marcia Myers. She is a Chico native. You were born here,
yes,
in Chico.
Yes, in the hospital.
And she describes herself as a philatelist, which is not limited to stamp collecting. She is a historian of the Postal Service?
Let's see. I'm a beginner, because I'll tell you, there are some philatelists out there and postal historians that are incredibly knowledgeable. When I went to Washington, D.C., I also went to the United States Postal Service headquarters in D.C. and met with 2 historians there and studied in their library as well. And I'm just at the tip of the iceberg with this. There's so much information. These people have spent a lifetime studying. And what my coffee table book shows is really just a selection and kind of personal interest, as well as that might be interesting to the general population, on the history of the Postal Service and philately.
Well, you mentioned going to the National Postal Museum, meaning the United States, but you go back farther than that in the history of letter writing and communication. So did you get any of that from, I wouldn't think, from the Smithsonian? Did they go back that far?
They do go back that far. Yes, they do. In fact, the picture of the postal horn is from the Smithsonian itself. The wax stamp is not. Connie, a graphic artist, and actually Ty Barber, who's a photographer, took a picture of my M wax stamp as a signature, basically, in this book. So that's used in the photography.
Well, you have a timeline, the evolution of communication, that goes back 6,000 B.C. And what did you learn from 6,000 B.C.,
well,
Marcia?
Let's look at that. These are charts that I put in at the very beginning.
You say that drums were used as a form of communication.
Yes.
And so that goes back around 6,000 B.C. Then you move forward to 2,000 B.C. when you have the first courier service established by the Egyptian pharaohs. And then about 500 B.C., we get a postal system in ancient Persia.
That's right.
And you say today more than 500 marathons take place each year worldwide because we have this Greek guy who runs 26 miles from Marathon to Athens to deliver a one-word message, victory.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
You include that because it is communication.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
On foot. And then around 200 B.C., people are sending smoke signals, messages along the Great Wall of China. And then you say that in Rome, in 59 A.D., there were slabs of stone and metal that were used to communicate a newspaper.
Yes.
And then around 1100 A.D., we've got the first state pigeon post in Egypt. So pigeons have been used to communicate for a long, long time.
Very long time. And also, over 3,000 years ago, they were used in China for letter carrying.
And so then about 1840, we get Samuel Morse inventing the telegraph. And so that was quite a revolution in long-distance communication.
Yes. This is all just kind of giving folks, I'm hoping to give people a general idea of, and even children or young adults that are just, they've only been trained on their cell phone. And so I'm trying to give people an idea of what it was like before.
My guest is Marcia Myers, and she has compiled a book that's more than just a book. It's coffee table size, and it contains a lot of photographs that she got from the National Postal Museum, from her own research in various places that she got these photographs. You say you have a photograph of a postal horn, and people might say, what? Did she say postal horn?
Yes.
What in the world is that?
It was a valveless brass or copper instrument, and it was used by mail carriers in the 18th and 19th centuries to signal the arrival or departure of a post rider in Europe, actually.
So just like a bugle might have sounded the charge during the Civil War, you've got this brass instrument that says, mail's here.
Exactly. And it's fun because actually Mozart, Mahler, and other composers incorporated the postal horn into their orchestras for specific purposes.
Yeah, that surprised me. And I didn't know that composers actually included the postal horn.
But today, there's still some postal horns around. In fact, there's one in the collection at the National Postal Museum. The instrument used today that they use would be the flugelhorn, cornet, or trumpet for that part of the piece.
So those instruments are familiar to us.
Yes.
The flugelhorn or the trumpet. So they were used in these classical compositions. And what else did you say you have that are kind of historical relics?
Okay, let's see. Just
sealing wax is nice, and people like to use that today.
It is, and in fact, I love to add that extra special personal touch of wax seals. And, you know, just a little tip, because the first time I went into the postal office to get my hand cancel that says Chico, California, I had a wax seal on the back. And the clerk said, oh, you're going to actually need to pay extra, and I need to send that through a special machine. It will get hooked up in the machine. You won't be able to get it there. Well, it took extra time. It took over a week to send it to a young girlfriend of mine in Chico.
And oh, so just across town. But the fact that you had this sealing wax on your envelope, that wax seal, it took a week to get across town.
It did. But actually, all of our mail goes from Chico to Sacramento first and then is returned back to Chico. Usually takes about 2 days. It's rare that I see it come the next day like it used to. Though what I found with the wax seal is as long as I don't take it to the clerk at the Postal Service and I put it in the mailbox, nothing special, forever stamp on it. It gets there in 2 days, no problem. So there's my tip with the wax seals.
But if the mail clerk sees it, he has to take special action on this letter.
Exactly, exactly.
So word to the listeners, if they want to put a seal on the wax seal on their envelope, that it's best to just drop it in the mail.
Something that I would like to share with you because it involves Butte County is it's a California pictorial letter sheet that I was able to obtain from a gentleman historian in Oroville, California.
Now that's an unfamiliar term, a letter sheet.
A California letter pictorial sheet. And a letter sheet is a visual account of the gold rush in California. In philatelic terminology, the letter sheet is an item of postal stationery issued by a postal authority. Letter sheets relished their greatest success during the 1850s. Gold miners used them when they arrived in California as one of the first ways to write back home, advising of their safe arrival and immediate destination into the mines.
So you might describe what a letter sheet looks like.
They're really quite beautiful. And the one that I saw, I was actually able to touch and handle. It was so fragile in person. Here, these were used during the 1850s. And this gentleman that is still alive today has a copy at his home in Oroville. They're generally printed on lightweight blue, gray, or white writing paper. The sheets were embellished with a woodcut or lithograph made from an artist's sketch.
So you have your photograph in your book. Yes. This woodcut is half the size of the whole page.
Yes, it is. It's actually, this sheet itself was a little bit larger than the page that we see here in the book. I would say it's closer to 9 by 12. I actually took this photograph myself. I, in fact, used my camera myself for a lot of photographs, photographing the different mailboxes and different collections that people had that I visited in Chico. But I did shoot this photo, and it was folded, as you can see, quite tightly.
Yeah, it has
tightly
a lot of creases in it.
Yes, yes. And a beautiful, I think it's Bidwell's Bar in Butte County, and it was from 1854.
Now, speaking of Bidwell's Bar, you have a section in your book where this Indian called Billy...
Swift Feather was his
Billy
name.
Billy Swift Feather.
Yes.
And he was asked to run in moccasins, on foot, run from this suspension bridge here locally when the bridge that opened in San Francisco, it took him, how long did it take him
it
to run that?
It wasn't the Golden Gate Bridge. It was the Bay Bridge in San Francisco. And I believe it took him just 2 days.
Well, you actually say that it took him 6 days.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, it has been a
longer.
While since I've fled through my book here.
it was 144.2 miles.
Yes.
This is on page 142 in your book, Marcia.
Okay.
That Billy Swift Feather ran 144.2 miles in 6 days in moccasins from the oldest suspension bridge west of the Mississippi River?
Yes. Yes, he did. In fact, he stopped to change his moccasins in Sacramento, and he must have eaten along the way. But 6 days, obviously, you would need to stop for that. But today, there's ultramarathoners that run 100 miles on a yearly basis.
But they have very nice running shoes
yes,
to do it.
Yes, they do. Though there's actually a book on barefoot running. That is a trend, or has been a trend in the past.
And you mentioned this oldest suspension bridge west of the Mississippi. Is which bridge was that?
This was the Oakland Bay Bridge.
Well, that's the one he ran to.
That's the one. Oh goodness,
the
excuse
one he ran
me.
From because
the
that's
one he
local.
Ran from was in Oroville.
So he runs from Oroville to the Bay Bridge.
The City of Gold, yes.
And what was he taking with him?
He actually took a letter. And I mean,
that was a pretty special courier.
Yes, it was. It was. There were many other people that went, though, from Chico, though not on foot. There was a woman that dressed as a señorita in black and white velvet, and she rode a stunning horse. There was a Pony Express rider that represented Placerville, California, and he and an Indian maiden was sent from Auburn riding an Indian pony.
My guest is Marcia Myers, and she has compiled a book she calls Special Delivery, which is a history of the postal system, a history of letter writing. How do you describe this unique book you've put together, Marcia?
It's the history of the Postal Service, the evolution of mail delivery, and the art of written communication. There's pop culture, artwork, fun factoids on sidebars, easy to read, bold print, beautiful photographs, past and present.
You mentioned these factoids, and I have one that I'll bet people don't know. What is the most expensive object by weight and size ever?
That would be the one cent magenta stamp, and it's owned today by Stuart Wiseman, who is a shoe designer.
So this teeny tiny little stamp by weight and size is the most expensive, most valuable object in the world.
Yes, it is. And it really just looks like a scrap of purple thin paper that was maybe possibly some red wine spilled on.
So this is what you mean by little interesting factoids that you have in the margins, the sidebars of your book. Now, we mentioned this young Indian who runs 144 miles, but there was a route that postal employees walked to deliver the mail. I thought, now there's a nice assignment.
Yes.
Do you know I'm talking about the beach walkers?
Are you talking about barefoot mail? Yes.
Yes, barefoot mail.
That was fun to come across. When I was creating the book, I was looking for anything unique and unusual that would be kind of shocking to somebody, that would be interesting to somebody as it sat on a coffee table. And barefoot mail was fun because it was done in Florida, and it was just, try walking in shoes along the beach. It's not very fun. You get sand in your boots. But barefoot, much quicker.
And I'm a fan of old movies, and so I was intrigued by the fact that there was a movie made about the barefoot mailman. And so if people are interested in that, they can check out that movie.
Yes, and in fact, I own a copy, an original copy signed by the author of that. It was written in 1940.
Yeah, so there's a book
there
and then
is
a movie
book
based on that movie.
Yes, and the book, I have not seen the movie, but I have read the book, and it's quite touching, actually. It's a love story.
Yeah, so you have a copy of that book.
I do.
Well, I want to talk to you some more about this fascinating history of mail delivery and the evolution of the postal system. But we are going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about mail on the moon, for example.
Moon mail, yes.
Moon mail. And you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is an author and philatelist, a local author born and grew up in Chico. Her name is Marcia Myers, and she did a lot of research in the National Postal Museum in Washington, D.C., and she feels that sending a letter is the next best thing to actually showing up personally at someone's door. Welcome back, Marcia.
Thank you for having me.
On your cover, you have the photograph of a mailman, and he's in a helmet. And I guess I've seen pictures of mailmen before in their uniform, but I didn't think about the fact that they're wearing helmets, like a safari helmet.
I love postal fashion. That was quite fun to research, as well as see when I was at the National Postal Museum and at the USPS headquarters in D.C. In fact, at the headquarters in D.C., there's a closet in the historian's office that has different jackets and different hats. And myself and Connie, who was traveling with me at the time, the graphic designer, actually tried them on and played with putting the hats on her head and putting the jackets on. That was at the headquarters. At the museum, of course, they're all under glass, and you're not able to do that.
Well, something that surprised me was, of course, these uniforms are supposed to last year-round, hot and cold.
Yes.
But I didn't know they made uniforms the fabric of alpaca.
Oh, my goodness. Some of them were incredibly warm and not convenient, not comfortable for the postman to wear while delivering the mail.
So it was a step forward to begin taking into account the season of the year and giving them seasonal uniforms.
Yes.
But you know what I found interesting, too? In 1895, women said, well, we want becoming uniforms. We want the uniforms to be flattering. If we're going to wear uniforms, we'd like for them to be flattering.
It was quite cute. In fact, women had to really work hard to promote themselves in the Postal Service in order to become carriers. The gentlemen did not want them carrying mail. They wanted them in the office as clerks or as helpers. But women, one woman, in fact, claimed that her sister could carry around two twin babies, which weighed more than a mail sack.
So, guys, what are you complaining about? We can take
exactly.
It. We're tough.
We can do it.
Well, I was somewhat surprised, too, that I thought that it was a rather recent development, women mail carriers, but not really.
No. In fact, women have been in the Postal Service for many years. In fact, Eisenhower, who was a president postmaster, his wife worked in the mail office. And it's said to believe that historians believe that she was actually the postmaster, even though he held the title.
Well, I would understand during World War II, when men were off at war, women had to step in and fill a lot of roles. And so I could understand how the Postal Service would hire a lot of women during that period of time in our history.
And that's exactly when it happened. Exactly. And then as we move forward into the 70s, women, instead of staying home, were going back to work, and it became a valued job for women to carry the mail.
My guest is Marcia Myers, and we're talking about her coffee table book, Special Delivery, about the evolution of the postal system and letter writing. And something that is was a nuisance. Now, most letters, we're so happy to get a letter. But then there were chain letters.
Yes.
I'm glad to see those disappear.
Me too. But they still show up in your email box.
In email, yes.
And they're starting to show up on our cell phones too. I mean, I'm getting random texts from people that they really don't have my phone number, but they're telling me I can win money or invest in a company or get a new interest rate. They're starting to come through. It's like,
well, for people who might not remember, tell them what a chain letter was.
A chain letter was something that you would receive in the mail, and it would suggest that you copy the letter and send it to 30 other friends or individuals. And if they didn't do it and they broke the chain letter, then ill fortune would come to them or something bad. You know, they would. It's like stepping on a crack and breaking your mother's back.
So you wouldn't dare not send that letter to however many friends and make sure that they also continue that chain. Well, some of the things that were put through the mail were surprising, Marcia. When I was reading your book, and I discovered some poor black cat got sent through the mail in New York.
Yes.
How did that come about?
That came about in a pneumatic tube. Today we see those at Costco. They put cash and checks in pneumatic tubes, and they're shot up to the office to secure money and get there safely to the person that's
within the same building.
Exactly. Well, these were sent under the city streets in New York City. And you know, the post office was always trying new innovative ways to try to get the mail to you quicker. and always safely. And so they used this service underneath the streets because it was quicker than being stuck in traffic, really, as a postal carrier.
So the system of pneumatic tubes under the streets of New York, and somebody puts a poor kitty in there.
Put a kitty. And, you know, today that's animal cruelty. I'm a cat lover. I can't imagine stuffing my cat in a pneumatic tube and sending it across, you know, a few blocks. But yes, they did. And it is said that the kitty arrived safely. He was dazed and confused. They gave him little treats and put him in his little bed, and he was fine. Difficult for me to imagine that, though.
Well, something else involving cats was cats were actually employees of the postal system.
Again, yes.
And why would they hire cats?
And this, again, was in New York City. A very large basement building. Many rats and mice came to the building, old city streets. Postal carriers would have lockers that had food, lunch, dinner, snacks. So rats and mice came in. And that became a cat's job to kill the mice or rats. And in fact, there was a postal employee that was employed specifically to take care of the cats in the building. And supposedly he gave him or gave the cats catnip or treats, little strips of beef or something. But they wanted the cats hungry so they could do their job well.
So we've got a cat wrangler as an employee of the Postal Service.
Yes.
To
yes.
take care of the rat and mice problem.
You know, there was actually another cat that I cover in the book called Tommy Post Office. Mm. And Tommy's mother was actually from the large city post office in New York City. And she had had a litter of kittens. And somehow one of her babies was shipped in a large mail bag.
And this was not intentional. Now, the other kitty was sent on purpose. But this little kitty
was accidentally shipped in a large mail bag, arrived safely at a post office, and he immediately became their mascot. In fact, they called him Tommy Post Office. In this book, I actually have photographed my cat, Bee, who sat in my office with me as I worked on this book, and she is on the mailbag in this book.
In fact, I recognize it because you give a word description. I thought, oh, that picture of the kitty I saw, that was Marcia's kitty.
Yes, yes, that's Bee from the Chico City shelter.
Well, there was another animal that was a part of the history of the Postal Service, and this was a dog.
Ah, yes.
And you have a photograph of this little dog with all these, kind of like a suitcase that has stamps of all the places the suitcase has been. This little dog had little metal labels. What would you call this?
They're metal tags.
Tags.
Like dog tags, really,
yeah.
But large and quite heavy. That was Oni, the male mascot, and he is said to have followed either his owner or just a postal carrier to work one day. And he kept coming back and staying at the post office. It was said that he probably didn't have a home, but they started feeding him. And eventually, he started riding the wagons with the mail. He loved the scent of mail bags and decided he liked going out with the carrier.
But it wasn't just locally.
No.
He went all over the United States, this little dog.
He did. And in fact, he went all over the world. He became quite famous because he was the mascot for the Postal Service. Every town he went to, there was a big show of newspaper writers and different businesses that all wanted to put their tag on his collar that had said that he had been to their store or their town. And eventually, he had so many tags that they had to build him a special harness in order to carry them all.
And you have a photograph of him in this special harness with all these tags attached.
Scruffy little mutt, yes.
And you also have, because we couldn't have read them on that photograph, but you have photographs of the actual tags. And I read all those tags. My goodness, this little dog did a lot of traveling.
He did.
And do you remember some examples of places that he went?
Oh, goodness. He went all over the world. He even rode mail cars. And he rode on the railroad system. And he went to Europe. I believe he went to
Canada,
West Coast,
so he was
Midwest, yes.
Everywhere. A well-traveled dog.
Yes, he was.
Now, you include, I'm a little reluctant to mention this one, but mail carriers are famous for having to guard against dogs. dog bites.
Yes.
And you say that in Chico one time, this guy, usually they got bit on the leg. They got bitten on the leg, and you have a photograph of some mail carriers with their pants leg lifted so they because they had gotten bitten on the leg or the ankle. But what happened to this poor mail carrier?
This is quite funny. I won't use his name, and I didn't use the name in the book. But a hot summer day in Chico, California, he's wearing his mail
summer
carrier
uniform.
His summer uniform, his appropriate shorts, not too short, not too long, delivering the mail on Manzanita Avenue. And a woman's chihuahua, little chihuahua, actually ran out the front door and ran up the... ran up the short pant leg of his shorts and nipped his left testicle. He carried on delivering the mail as most postal carriers would, finished his route that day, but went straight to urgent care for a little test and some antibiotics.
So we have that expression, neither rain nor sleet nor snow should deter the mail, but we don't think about, nor dog bites.
Right. In fact, oh, so true. There's over 6,000 dog bites a year on mail carriers, and that's quite a lot.
And you even list the cities where it's most common.
Yeah, very common is in Southern California. And that, you know, I wonder if more dogs are outside because of the weather. It is a big problem, in fact. And so, yes, I would imagine that postal carriers have to keep their tetanus shots up to date.
Yeah, with the mild weather in the Los Angeles area, for example, it's more likely the dog would be out and able to bite the poor mail carrier.
It usually comes from a dog that the resident says, oh, don't worry, my dog won't bite. And sure enough.
Yeah, because that's what they think.
Yes, I know a few carriers that carry little dog bones or chews just to put them off track in case.
Uh-huh. It'd be nice because they could spray them with mace, but it's much nicer to have a little dog treat instead.
Exactly.
My guest is author and philatelist, Marcia Myers, and she has explained that a philatelist is a person wider than just a stamp collector. In fact, you're not really a stamp collector. Would you say that's true, that you collect interesting information about stamps?
Information about stamps, but postal history and any article that has to do with historic postal history. So envelopes, stamps, letters. I'm specifically interested in the evolution of mail delivery, which isn't something that's collectible. There's photographs that you could collect.
But you can't collect any physical object.
No, and in fact, you don't have to own a physical object to be a philatelist.
That's interesting. Now, something else that you mentioned in your book, and I had not thought about the fact that mailboxes used to be olive green. And I thought, well, it's sometimes hard to find the mailbox. It's olive green, and I would expect it to be red, white, and blue. And you explained that that a red mailbox was controversial. You say that in your book. I thought, how could a red mailbox be controversial?
First of all, the drab olive green was because there was a surplus of paint from the war.
World War One.
Exactly. And so
they got all this paint lying around after the war, and they said, okay, we're going to paint the mailboxes olive green.
Right. And the controversy of red was because it was actually used in Europe and in China. And red, white, and blue, we see postal boxes that color today. But I'm talking about specifically post boxes on people's homes as well as on the street.
Well, how did it come about that they delivered to people's homes? Because in the beginning, they did not.
No, they did not.
You say that in 1863, that was the first time when mail was actually delivered to homes, but it was city homes. People who lived in a town, in a city, could get their mail delivered to their home. And people could or could not do that if they chose in the beginning. But you say in 1923, they made the mailbox mandatory, even if it was just a slot in the door.
And it actually used to be the recipient that paid for the envelope or the mail and not the addressee. And that was quite troublesome because it could be that the person wasn't aware that they were getting mail and they did not have the money to pay for it, or they refused it, and then it would be sent back or actually never delivered.
And the Postal Service got no recompense for that.
No, they did not. For that. No, they did not.
And I was intrigued by the fact that these mailboxes now on city streets used to be more common in Chico than they are now, because one day I had something I wanted to mail, and I saw the mailman walking along, and I said, where's the nearest mailbox? I thought there used to be mailboxes that you could drop your letter in downtown. And he said, well, we had to take them out. And do you know why, Marcia?
I'm not sure about Chico specifically, but most people attach their letter to their mailbox at home because every...
And put the flag up.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. There has been some problems with theft. And so they're no longer... They're maybe afraid to do that. But I think it's because of so much email and so many other electronic...
Now, the mailman told me, because I handed it to him in his hand, and he took it very nicely, but he said they had to remove some of them because things other than letters were being tossed into the mailboxes downtown.
Now that's quite possible. The very happy partiers throwing a beer bottle, or worse yet, I've actually heard of someone opening the box and vomiting.
Yes, that's what
in
he
the
said.
Mailbox.
I hated
yes.
bringing it up, but that's what the mailman said.
Yes, that happens everywhere, not just in Chico, California.
Oh, well, I suppose that's a little.
It is.
Reassuring. So when I'm going to go back to when they were delivering mail at the homes. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, the mailman was supposed to knock when he delivered mail.
Yes.
And if he goes around his whole route knocking on the door, his poor knuckles are going to get pretty tired.
Very sore, deep calluses. And in fact, someone invented a knocker. It looks something like a doorknob. I would love to have a door knocker from the postal collection. But
in fact, Marcia, when I opened that page and I saw this photograph of this oddly shaped thing, and I thought, what in the world is that? That you say it looks like a doorknob, only two attached to each other.
Exactly.
And so I thought, what in the world is that? And so then when I read that page, I thought, oh, that's what that is. That's what the mailman carried around with him to preserve his knuckles when he had to knock on everybody's door to announce you've got a letter.
Exactly.
Or you've got mail.
Special delivery.
Special delivery. So they're delivering mail on foot to houses. But then along comes airplanes.
to houses, there were steamships used, railway mail used. There's air mail, and that was quite wonderful. But that was a dangerous job. There were many accidents with pilots. And actually, Charles Lindbergh, famous Charlie Lindbergh, was worked for the Postal Service for a very short time before he did his famous flight. And after that, he was so popular, he flew for himself and carried first day covers, which were envelopes, as advertisements for the Postal Service, always supporting the service. Yes.
So Charles Lindbergh was an employee of the Postal Service, but there's another famous flyer who was unofficially carrying mail, like 50 pieces of mail. And who was she?
That was Amelia Earhart. And her beautiful leather flight suit actually is at the Smithsonian's National Postal Museum.
Yes, you have a beautiful photograph of her leather flight suit of Amelia Earhart. Mm-hmm. And she was unofficially carrying mail.
She was. She was, again, sending first day covers, envelopes, that whenever there was a new stamp released, it was often that a first day cover, which is an envelope, that would also show a piece of art depicting that stamp, would be released as a collector's item. And Amelia was carrying those.
So sometimes you mentioned that there were crashes, and you have some photographs of the airplane nose down. Fortunately, the ones you have, the pilot is standing there so that he survived and was okay. But you would mention that there was delivered by steamship. There was a short time when it was delivered by Pony Express. And I think most people would be surprised at what a short time is. Only 18 months.
18 months.
From 1860 to 1861, the mail was actually delivered by Pony Express.
Yes.
And I had come across this before, the description of who they wanted. When they were hiring employees to deliver the mail by pony, they wanted somebody who was preferably an orphan.
skinny, wiry, and under the age of 18.
They wanted a teenager delivering the mail. Very specific. They want some skinny little kid because weight mattered. And then I saw that, but they issued them Bibles.
They did. They didn't. It was rare for them to carry the Bible because the Bible was so heavy.
That's what I thought. There's a picture of this large, heavy Bible when they're trying to hire skinny kids so they will be light.
And sadly, many of the Pony Express, it was a very dangerous job. They were either killed by bandits because they didn't just carry mail, they carried gold and other valuables, or they were killed because of wild animals. Or they even starved to death if their horse was sick and they couldn't make it to the next town.
So it was a very dangerous occupation to be a Pony Express deliverer, mail deliverer.
Very few pictures of Pony Express riders. In fact, I believe we have the one that is from the National Postal Museum of the young man next to his horse. And it isn't of the highest quality, but you can see that he was...
So you didn't include it in your book?
No, he's there. He's there. He's
I didn't remember that.
Yes, yes. And then I show a stable as well as a monument, which is in Sacramento, California, by the Railroad Station Museum.
Well, another thing that surprised me, I mean, I did know that it was just a short period of time that there were Pony Express deliverers, but the logo, now you say that the Postal Service does not have an official logo.
They do not.
But for a long time, they had a person riding a horse, and I hadn't thought about it, but I thought, well, there's a Pony Express deliverer, but that's not the case.
No, no.
He's not representing the Pony Express.
He's not. Another item that was used is not an unofficial logo was Mercury. And I have a special...
The god.
Yes, the god,
the
messenger.
Or the messenger god, Mercury.
The wings on his ankles.
And helmet.
And I have a tattoo on my ankle of Mercury's wings. I actually had it done, the artwork, very small, when I was 43 years old. I'm 51 now. It was well before I even had thought of this book. And the reason why I had it done is I was a runner for many years in Bidwell Park and always have picked up feathers. I've been drawn to feathers. And so it was quite fun for me to see in some of the artwork for special delivery that Mercury was actually used as...
In fact, that's the cover, the actual hardcover of your book.
In
copper foil is of Mercury.
Very Art Deco style. In fact, I went back and forth with Connie. We decided to use both because I like both logos so much. I like
one for the hardcover and one for the dust jacket.
Yeah, the dust jacket is much more romantic, black and white, something that would be favorable on a coffee table. But if you didn't like that look, you could just remove the dust jacket and have
this beautiful copper
foil
artwork
of Mercury.
Speaking of artwork in the Postal Service, the post office in Chico has a mural. Mural art has kind of faded from the scene. Used to have beautiful murals in the post offices.
Yes.
But what is on the Chico post office mural?
The Pony Express.
That's another thing that surprised me. That I think is why we think that the Pony Express was a longer time, because it has lived for so long.
It has. And it's been romanticized and always in movies and books. And they make it much more romantic than it actually was.
So their mural on our post office downtown has a Pony Express rider.
Yes, it does.
And you mentioned that you have also letters that you have preserved in your book. And one of the ones that I was amused, a young 11-year-old, and I had heard this story before, but not as many of the details, writes Abraham Lincoln, says, "Mr. Lincoln, your face is so thin that, you know, you'd really look good with whiskers." She didn't say beard. She said whiskers. And she also said that women love whiskers.
Very cute letter. And I included a few letters. They were throughout the book because they're personal interest letters. We all love Abraham Lincoln. And it's a sweet letter that she wrote. She has brothers and she wanted to see him as president. And in fact, after she wrote that letter, he did win as the president and she met him just one time. He stepped down off a train and and gave her a kiss.
And that part I didn't know. I'd heard this young woman had suggested that he grow a beard. And again, in her letter to him, she says, all the ladies like whiskers. So that was an 11-year-old. You include some letters, Jack Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy, that were a little heartbreaking, actually, Marcia.
They are. He was Kennedy. There were letters that were actually sold. A woman that had had a brief affair with Kennedy while he was engaged to Jacqueline.
Just weeks before he's going to marry Jackie.
He did. But she had kept them in her special keepsake box for a very long time, but when she became ill, her family decided to sell them, and they were auctioned off at an auction house to the highest bidder.
So you do have letters like that. Now, there's one very famous letter around this time of year, and you included in your book a Christmas time letter, this young woman who's saying, you know, people are saying there isn't a Santa Claus. And who is this famous young woman? How old was she?
Her name was Virginia. And the famous letter is actually, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. She was just 8 years old.
So this 8-year old is saying, people are telling me there isn't a Santa Claus. And who does she write this letter to?
Well, she had had many in-depth conversations with her father about whether or not there really was a Santa Claus. And her father, tired of her questioning, he suggested to write a letter to the editor.
What editor now? And where is she?
The editor of The Sun, which went on to become and remains to this day the most reprinted English language editorial in history.
And she lives in New York City.
Yes, she does.
And she sends her letter. Well, why does she address it to The Sun?
Because her father...
Yeah, her dad said, well, if you see it in The Sun,
it
must be true.
If you see it in The Sun, it's so. If you see it in The Sun, it is so.
So she writes a letter to the editor of The Sun, this newspaper in New York. And what does she write to the editor? What's her question there?
Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it in The Sun, it is so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus?
And then what does the editor write back?
Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except what they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they are men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. And you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there was no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias.
Isn't that a sweet letter?
It's very sweet.
This is Marcia Myers, and she is reading a letter written by the famous child Virginia, asking if there really is a Santa Claus. And this is included in her book, Special Delivery, Marcia Myers' book, that is, Special Delivery. Thank you so much, Marcia.
Thank you.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.